listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
In these times, we have to unify. We have to come together and send one very clear, strong, unmistakable message that acts or threats of political violence of any kind have no place in the United States of America.
But it is a troubling time, isn't it? And it's a time of deep divisions, and we have to do everything we can to bring our country together.
Two voices from the 2016 election, President Donald Trump and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, reacting to news of a series of pipe bombs being discovered targeting prominent opponents of President Trump's administration. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia. It's a really unique moment, except there's another unique moment almost just like it, which is around the time of 9/11, 2001, when you had all the anthrax being mailed to people. And we're trying to, you know, I'm looking at the group of targets here today. As a matter of fact, it's even being reported that way. These are all people that have, you know, are opponents of Trump. That Trump has spoken harshly about in one fashion or another in the main, most of them, and that it's being painted as if this, you know, must come from some Trump supporter because of Trump's, you know, angry rhetoric, exciting, you know, crazy people, crazy white nationalists or whatever. But while they're talking that, this comes 2 days after the New York Times, if you want to speak about something unique. The book review section, rather than reviewing books, actually publishes five stories about how Trump goes out of office, including one where he's assassinated with a Russian here to silence him because the world's about to find out he is, in fact, Putin's puppet. And when the Russian-made gun fails, The Secret Service agent pulls his gun out. The Russian thinks he's done for, and the Secret Service agent said, here, use mine. Mm-hmm. This is published in the New York Times on Tuesday.
Yeah. I would say that this current bomb threats and so on is like the Russiagate, a false flag. I would say this current thing is about 75%, I'm certain it's a false flag, and it's a part of the taking back the House and creating an atmosphere of extreme fear and paranoia among the electorate. I think it's going to backfire. I mean, at best or worst, whatever side you're on of this, it's going to frighten people away from the polls and people who would potentially vote for the Democrats. But it is a manifestation of a certain crisis of democracy, and as we've talked so often, a crisis of rule where the masses of people, the demos, to use the Greek word, which is the prefix in the word democracy, the demos are in rebellion against the elite and democratic rule, which in its pure form suggests that the people rule, but the people rule because they are informed by their leaders and self-informed through discourse and debate. And Russiagate and this current thing, these bombs, is a way of cutting off discourse, of cutting off political debate, no matter how nasty it could become. And of course, Donald Trump is a master at ratcheting up the nasty part of it, but that's a part of discourse as well. But what we're seeing now is the elites and what we now know, or we call the deep state, trying to, and forgive the irony, trying to trump the people's will. And so, you know, there's a crisis of democratic theory, and it's always a question of could democracy of people's rule and capitalism coexist? And you know, all of the democratic theorists, including Marx and Lenin and Du Bois, the three that I just mentioned, question whether or not capitalism and democracy could work. Of course, Lenin and Du Bois said that, well, rights of the working class in the advanced capitalist countries was based upon the exploitation of colonial labor in the rest of the world.
Right.
Now we're seeing that system collapse, and there is a crisis of democracy in the advanced countries.
Yeah, so, this is interesting because just to interrupt for a second,
before
we get too far from the point, first with the you know, to sort of to encapsulate all that, you know, you go to the Greek source demos, which means people. For democracy, it's demos kriton or kraton, which is people's rule. And when you have the people in people's rule rebelling against the rule, it tells you something about the intrinsic nature of that rule. In fact, it's not a people's rule in the first place, because otherwise it would be impossible for them to rebel against their own rule. Now you take a look at the nature of this system and, you know, of capitalism, which it is rests upon and has been inextricably, you know, uplifted, developed with imperialism, with colonialism, which is an international form of class war. It's just simply one based on geography, and sort of discrete levels of stratification, but still classes. Here's the owning class. We own your country. Here's the laboring class. We're being made to carry our stuff to the boat so that you can take it away. And that is, as we've discussed for, you know, that you brought to this conversation 2 years ago, at least now, 3 years ago, that's really the central point of contention between Trump and the deep state, which is Trump apparently looking to do some sort of, you know, recognizing or seeing that imperial retreat is necessary and trying to move towards that, and there being a deep state reaction to it. That's the reaction to the people.
And you know, if you just follow the narrative, they're saying, in effect, that populism, which means popular or the populace, and democracy don't go together.
Right.
And therefore, the populace or the popular will has to be contained and controlled.
Right.
And what they're literally saying is, well, we don't have a problem with Trump as an individual, but he has riled up the population and turned them against our, quote, democratic institutions, including the presidency, the electoral system, the media, and so on.
Right.
And therefore, since he has riled up the population or represented the anger of the population against the elites and the institutions controlled by him, he must therefore be a fascist.
Right.
When in effect, it could be the opposite, that those who control the institutions of, quote, democracy themselves might be the real fascists.
Right.
And this might be, ironically, in embryo, an anti-fascist movement. And what I'm suggesting, and I'll stop right here, what I'm suggesting is to think clearly about this moment. Things might be the opposite of what we have generally thought them to be. So, yes. And of course, you know, the reputed despicables and racist might be less racist than the people who are pointing fingers at them.
Right. Yeah, you know, there's an interesting piece at consortiumnews.com on that last point, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
Where, and I'll have the piece in a second, but the author of the piece points to the outreach done by the Black Panthers, the author being Colette Gaeter, and I guess it was originally published in The Conversation. Well, the title is kind of self-explanatory. When Black Panthers aligned with Confederate flag-wielding working-class whites.
Mm-hmm.
And where it goes to is that essentially the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense looking around at building, you know, a revolutionary movement that, you know, really could be one beyond just the people that the Black Panther Party could reach. And one of the groups they found was the Young Patriot Organization in Chicago, in Hillbilly Harlem, as they called it. They were many of them were racist. Not all of them, by the way. Although this seems, you know, sort of counterintuitive because their organization clearly looked and was in many ways racist. They had you know, used the Confederate flag and all that stuff, but the Panthers said, you know, we need this, and this is Fred Hampton. He wanted to form the Rainbow Coalition of working class and poor people of all races.
Right.
And so they look around and they said, we got, if we can reach these guys, then we're way on, way down the road.
Yeah.
And it worked. It worked.
Of course.
And
of course.
Then you know what happened to Fred Hampton.
Right. Of course. And you're absolutely, and I, you know, I knew Fred Hampton, and I was not surprised when he made such a move, because we were in a study group together on the south side of Chicago, and the book that we were studying together was Das Kapital. So,
well, that's him. I am a proletarian. He stressed that all the time. And then just one other thing for people to keep in your mind. You're aware of this already, obviously, but, you know, the ones that got targeted Take a look around at who survives, and then take a look at who was killed. Malcolm X, and when he was killed, for example, was almost immediately after he left the Black Nationalist perspective of the
Nation of Islam.
And started talking about Islam in general, his experience in Mecca, and wanting to come back, not abandoning struggle and organizing the Black community, but looking next to it, as we have to ally with all of these people. Bam, gone. The same Martin Luther King, of course, he always had this perspective in his organizing, but looking at organizing workers, not just Black workers, but Black workers. I mean, that's when he was organizing the sanitation workers when he was murdered in Memphis. That's exactly what he was doing. But he was talking that same thing. Unity, working class unity. Bam, gone.
And, that's right. And of course, you know, when you talk about working class unity, back then, they were calling it out-of-control populism. That Martin Luther King, by linking racism, poverty, and anti-war, was, you know, agitating the masses to go against the elites. I mean, we see the same thing today. And therefore, things must be looked at in their opposites, not what especially not what the elite and mainstream media are saying. The other thing about this, you know, with the collapse of the system of U.S. Empire, which is a world system dominated by U.S. finance capital and the U.S. military, with that in collapse and retreat, and Donald Trump giving voice to that in contradictory ways. And we can talk about that. Donald Trump, the man with his views, and Donald Trump, the politician, especially the way he has to play it politically in the 2018 elections, who he has to appeal to save his presidency and to prevent a House which would, for the next 2 years, create a toxic environment for him to govern in. So,
a declared goal. I mean, that's a declared goal.
Well, they've said it. Even though they have this fig leaf of health care, the real content and intent of 2018 is to get a House majority that could begin something like impeachment. But the whole point is to destabilize his presidency, which, by the way, as I read the Bob Woodward book, Fear, it was clear that it took him about a year to get control of the White House. You know what I'm saying? And by the way, the Bob Woodward book is 80%, if not more, about the debates within the West Wing about foreign policy and trade policy. And they were some, you know, vicious battles among the so-called White House staff and such. And the White House, again, was operating separate from the administration. That is the Secretary of Education and Housing. All of that was something else. The battles were for the control of the policy. Direction of the U.S. state in foreign policy. This is the key. And the reaction, the Russiagate, this current thing, the fight to take back the House, is all about the U.S. empire. Now, I would say this. There are those on the other side of Trump who recognize that imperial retreat is inevitable and necessary, but they want to slow walk it. Donald Trump wants to fast-track imperial retreat. And they are saying, the opposition, that this is too risky. They realize, those who are rational, that this is an inevitable retreat. You see, this notion that he is a fascist, and this is a smear, and it's not based upon any scientific definition of fascism. And to make him a Key Mussolini point. Or a Hitler
right.
is so crazy.
Right.
That, you know, but.
Right, because he ain't that, and this ain't the 30s no. either, by the way. It's not just
no.
who is Trump, but who are we and what are we compared to what we were 80, 90 years ago?
That's right. But see, if he were a fascist, like a Hitler, Hitler wanted to expand German imperialism. Hitler wanted to overthrow the Soviet government. Donald Trump is talking about the opposite, a retreat
That's right.
from hegemony, rather than a unipolar, a multipolar world.
Right.
He wants to do away with NATO and the World Trade Organization.
Right.
And again, you know, he and Putin are going to meet in Europe on November the 11th. For a mini summit
yep.
where I'm certain they're going to talk about restarting nuclear arms treaties and so on.
Like a new environment for that stuff, even. I
absolutely.
Agree.
Absolutely. But, you know, this is a very, and as you put it, I mean, fictionalizing his assassination as a step towards actualizing it.
Right, that's right. Whether it encourages some nut job that now has the cover of a mm-hmm. public narrative started by the respectable New York Times, so it's believable that this nut job would do this all on their own, or even yeah. as a cover story for the other kind of nut job, somebody that's on the CIA's payroll,
yeah.
you know, that goes in there thinking they're going to get a hero's motorcade, and instead they get killed as the assassin, which is what you
do. Yeah. Yeah, I think it would be far more sophisticated than that, and it would be a Hail Mary pass because
yeah, right.
it would destabilize the political environment.
Yeah,
and I think almost immediately take the political civil war to
That's
an armed
street.
Civil war
yeah,
in the United States.
Before we get there, because I want to you know flesh out 2 points that you made. For illustration, one is, you know, as they're talking about Trump as the fascist, and you mentioned the contradictions in Trump as a, you know, product of working class uprising, in essence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, we have Bernie Sanders represented pretty much exactly the same thing inside the Democratic Party, largely white. That people are forgetting that now, but that was daily in the media back during the campaign, as Clinton surrounded herself with brown and black faces on television mm-hmm. every day, mm-hmm. any 10 people
Absolutely.
She could find. You know, they were pointing to Bernie as being some old white Jewish guy that, you know,
mm-hmm.
ain't in touch with the communities of color. So you had that element, just like Trump. Mm-hmm. Not the same, but close enough. You also had the real, you know, economic interests driving the surprising lift of that candidate. But now if you look at the essential difference, it's the same one that shows you who's on which side right now. Because Bernie Sanders was talking about Hugo Chavez, the dead communist dictator, and getting tough with Putin and all this other stuff. And he's continued to say that. He's beaten the Russiagate drum as loud as anybody is. And so, you know, as I stand as a Bernie bot behind the Democratic Party and point to Trump as a fascist, what exactly am I when I'm supporting the war policy, yeah. that these Democrats are supporting? So on that point, you know, who's the fascist is pretty clear, actually. A question of war and
yeah.
peace. You see where that is. There's one other thing that's a part of that. Now, you go ahead and do what you're doing, and then I'll see if we need to add this in, because there's something else
yeah.
that struck me.
Well, I was going to say, a part of the problem of the left and progressive forces is a deep mistrust and distrust of white working people.
Yeah.
You know, they cannot believe that white working people would be the ones who would be in the leadership of an uprising against right. the establishment.
You know,
but that's precisely what is happening.
It's kind of weird. I just want to tell you on my Facebook page to illustrate that point. I can't tell you how many different people, white people, were telling me, you know, that how evil nationalism, basically, you know, whitesplaining, but as if they were social justice warriors, that mm-hmm. pointing to some member of their family as an example right. of how racist white people are.
Yeah. But, you know, again, I mentioned, I think last time, Ben Bradley Jr.'s book on Luzerne County in the center of Pennsylvania, who never voted for Republican for president since 1988, and before that, since the 1930s, probably, and voted for Obama twice, but in 2016 voted for Trump. Right. The question is, how do you explain that? And that's not a middle-class suburb. It is not any of those things that are supposed to fit the Trump demographic. It's a coal mining area. Right. It's a deindustrialized area. It's overwhelmingly white and would be considered liberal. I mean, the fact of the matter is the so-called left and progressives distrust, have no confidence in class, and they have turned, therefore, to identity politics and really forms of anarchism. Protest without any strategic or tactical vision. And they do this in isolation from what is so palpable and clear, a uprising and anger based upon class. The other thing I would say, it is so noticeable, it's almost shameful that the left no longer even talks about the unions.
Right.
And of course, the mass media, the mainstream media, has not even sought out Richard Trumka to give his opinion on renegotiated NAFTA or on TPP or on Trump's international trade policies with China and with Europe and with Canada and so on and so forth. What are workers, especially workers in industrial unions in the center of the country, what are they saying? Well, clearly, and this is very telling, I think, Don, you don't hear a word about the unions campaigning for anyone in the midterm elections. I'm certain they are, but the unions have not thrown all of their weight behind the Democrats, because I think the unions, at least at the leadership level, certainly the rank and file decided what they're about already, but at the leadership level, they feel at this time they have to hedge their bets. On Trump and trade, they're with him.
Yep.
On some other things, maybe not. And on immigration, they are with him.
Yeah.
Because they understand how all of this fits into a global system of higher and higher profits and lower wages and greater poverty for the working class.
Yep.
And on this point, I'll stop right here. On this point, black and white workers in their thinking about the world are closer together maybe than they have been in 70 years, maybe 60 years.
Yep.
And I would suggest to you, although it is not very obvious, black working people and the poor are part of this uprising, especially in the Midwest, in places like Detroit and Flint, in Milwaukee, in these small towns, industrial towns in Ohio and other places. So, I mean, we're in a full-scale rebellion, and I think the best thing for the ruling class to do is to find some compromise with Trump, allow him to govern, and let's get on with solving some of the problems of the country. I don't think they're going to do that, however.
Well, you know, there's a great deal of latent hope, I guess.
Yes.
It was evident when we were in Cleveland in 2016, because, you know, we've discussed part of this, this main point many times, that, you know, the so-called left was going to organize to shut down the RNC, and then they accomplished nothing. There was no local actions whatsoever. Now, That means, A, they couldn't get people to come from around the country to Cleveland to do that, and B, they couldn't, or two, or whatever, they couldn't mobilize locally.
And you so remember,
here's the point.
The irony of the whole thing was that a guy who was protesting, he was going to burn the American flag
and,
ended up setting himself on fire.
Yeah. But yes, I do. This is from the RCP. But there's this point, which we haven't discussed before. And this goes to the point, and they couldn't organize people locally. Who's the people locally? 53.3% of them are black in Cleveland.
Right, okay.
There was no local protest against Trump in a black city, in essence.
Right.
So, you know, there's like, you know, an awful lot of links.
When we came to Philadelphia, there were thousands marching against
thousands,
Hillary.
Thousands here, thousands there, thousands everywhere, including inside the forum, the delegates themselves.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is definitely a spirit of rebellion in the air, and it's being managed by the media, by the political establishment, by everything, every cartoon that every kid was fed instead of a book when we were kids, whatever it is that's driving it. People are, you know, being driven into motion, and they're because I guess the powers that be see that that's inevitable. The people are in motion, and so now the game is to try to lead them down a dead end or in a circle, and you know, that is what we see happening when I saw evidence of it this weekend. I went to the Women's March on the Pentagon and heard Cindy Sheehan say in an interview, and which I had seen happen when it was happening, but never really clicked. Well, we decided to do this after we went to the people who organized the inauguration and the anniversary inauguration women's marches and said we wanted to make sure that they made a demand to shut down the military machine. And they said to me, Cindy, war is your issue, not ours. And so, okay, that is the condition of the leadership that's organizing these mass protests against Trump.
Mm-hmm.
War, and on the question of war and peace, they're not interested. So we're out of time. So, Tony, I'd like to continue this next week, but appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Don.
Oops. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. After almost 2 years in office, many still question whether Donald Trump has a coherent foreign policy. The same cannot be said about the president's national security advisor, John Bolton. When you think of Bolton, the words subtlety and diplomacy don't come to mind. So, is there now a Bolton doctrine? Cross-talking Bolton's foreign policy, I'm joined by my guest, Ted See in Oxford. He's a senior policy consultant at the British American Security Information Council. In San Francisco, we have John Rainwater. He is the executive director of Peace Action. And in New York, we cross to Alice Slater. She is a member of the coordinating committee of World Beyond War. Cross-talk rules in effect, everyone. I'm going to go to John first in San Francisco, because I always go to the person that gets up earliest for this, and I'm very thankful that you did get up so early. And I wouldn't be surprised if you had a coffee mug in your hand. John, let me go to you. When Donald Trump was campaigning and after he was elected, everyone was saying that he was going to be an isolationist. Then he went through a few iterations of his foreign policy team. And now with John Bolton on the scene and apparently calling a lot of the shots, the fear of isolationism is really turned into the worry of unilateralism in a time when multilateralism is gaining pace. Well, your thoughts, John, go ahead.
Well, I think that's exactly right. Those who thought that Trump might have an anti-militarist streak are being very disappointed right now, and you are seeing the influence of Bolton in this attempt to pull out of the INF treaty. But I think it goes beyond that to a lot of Trump's advisors that are just looking to stoke a new arms race. And that's what's dangerous about what's going on right now, is we're hitting the rewind button to the 90s and really unconstrained arms race, the type of which we haven't seen since the Cold War. And that's what we need to avoid here.
Allison, I get the impression that that's exactly what the Trump administration wants or is threatening, is an arms race. We'll just bury them with all of our money spent on the military, which is amazingly bloated right now. I mean, this is a threat, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, well, Trump himself is a threat. He's an unguided missile. He campaigns saying, I'm going to make a deal with North Korea. I'm going to make a deal with Russia. I'm going to get rid of NATO. And the Democrats and Republicans came down on him so hard. I think almost he hired Bolton to defend himself from the, you know, they actually voted in the Congress not to allow the U.S. to get troops out of North Korea after he had that meeting. So, you know, this is systematic corruption and influence of the military-industrial complex in the United States. And it's going to be an opportunity to really get everybody up. We shouldn't be talking about maintaining this treaty. That's ridiculous. 122 nations just signed a treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons and ban them and make them unlawful the way we have for chemical and biological. And Russia and the U.S. and China and France and England, you know, the non-proliferation treaty powers, they're boycotting it, they're twisting arms not to support it. The language now should be it's time to ban the bomb, not just to do another arms control measure. I mean, we were breaking arms control for years with when we walked out of the ABM treaty. Russia never kept complaining. We never did a thing about it.
Well, I mean, but Russia said there would be consequences, and I think we're going to see that. You know, Ted, it seems to me, you know, with the advent of arms control agreements in the late 60s, all the way up to, well, I guess a few days ago, that was a nonpartisan issue. They were almost like sacred cows that you really don't touch. And it seems very quickly now the entire architecture of arms control and nonproliferation is turning into tatters in front of our eyes. Go ahead, Ted.
Thank you, Peter. I would say, having 26 years of experience as an American diplomat, most of that concerned with arms control, with nonproliferation, with the elimination of entire classes of weapons, that what Alice is talking about is the real danger and the real challenge here. We're looking at a world where arms control may not be enough. We're looking at a need for declaring first that nuclear weapons are unlawful and having all of the powers sign on to that, and then do something about reducing the thousands of active nuclear weapons that are still out there. Okay, we're down from, you know, scores of thousands to mere, you know, under 20,000 now. That's not good enough. We have to bring it down into the low hundreds, and then we have to get rid of them entirely. And that's not going to be an easy process, and it's not going to be a quick one. But the problem with looking at the INF treaty in isolation is that what you've actually got is a massive hole where a European security architecture ought to be.
Yep.
There's been divisions within the last few years in particular between Western Europe and the Russian Federation, and that's unhealthy because Russia is a European power in addition to being a global power, obviously. But the rest of Europe needs to deal with Russia on that basis. And so talking about something like a dead letter like the INF treaty is like talking about the Washington or the London naval treaties of the 20s and 30s. It's irrelevant because what's actually broken is the entire architecture.
You know, John, the issue of these treaties, I mean, we had the Iran nuclear deal, and now we have this. But Trump is always saying, you know, let's come up with a new agreement here. But I mean, if you know, if you put yourself in the shoes of North Korea, would you sign an agreement with the United States when it comes to nuclear weapons? I mean, it's the credibility gap is growing wider and wider. I mean, why would any American president say, I want to conclude agreements while he's breaking ones left and right? Go ahead, John, in San Francisco.
That's absolutely right. And there's really nothing stopping Trump or anyone else to go to the table with the Russians and improve on the architecture that exists. Obviously, it's flawed. There are holes in it. But that doesn't mean you throw out what you have that has been relatively successful up to now. And, you know, when, like you're saying, you're throwing out the Iran agreement, you're throwing out the INF, it makes negotiating new agreements even more difficult. The only thing Trump has left is to rename things like NAFTA, give them a new name. But that's not diplomacy. And what's disappointing about the INF treaty in a lot of ways is that the U.S. could have gone to the table with Russia. Sure. There are technical ways of solving the problems that were there in terms of inspections, reciprocal exhibitions. Those could have solved the problems that the two countries had instead of walking away from the table. But what's scary is that these countries want to have an arms race, and that makes banning these nuclear weapons all the more difficult when you're barreling 180 degrees in the opposite direction.
You know, Alice, there's a lot of European, particularly the Germans, have come out against the Americans walking away from the treaty. I mean, this creates, the treaty came into effect to actually protect Europe. With the Americans walking away from it, it creates an enormous amount of uncertainty right now in what directions the European, I mean, in Western Europe, they don't want American weapons. Of course, maybe in Eastern Europe and in the Baltics, they might welcome them. But the entire security architecture is listing right now because we don't know what the new realities are going to be. And adding the new range of weapons certainly doesn't create stability, and making the kind of claim or demand that China has to be part of this is ridiculous. I mean, China has these weapons, Iran has these weapons, India is developing these weapons here. I mean, a smart person interested in arms control would get all these countries that have these weapons or developing them and have a global pact. But that's not part of John Bolton's DNA, is it?
Listen, we already have a global pact. We signed it in 1970. We promised to get rid of all our nuclear weapons in the non-proliferation treaty. Obama was going to spend $1 trillion over 30 years for two new bomb factories in Oak Ridge and in Los Alamos, new submarines, missiles, airplanes, bombs, new smarter, smaller nuclear weapons they're talking about. A smaller nuclear weapon is as big as what hit Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, we have to change the conversation. We got a climate report last month that if we don't mobilize the whole world to move immediately to solar and wind and geothermal, we're going to have, the Earth is going to abandon us. So how could we be wasting all these resources and IQ points on new nuclear weapons or fixing a little treaty that didn't get rid of them? It's just step by step to nowhere. We have to change this conversation to getting rid of all of them.
Ted, you know, if you look at these postures, security and defense posture reports that have come out under the Trump administration, it is truly shocking, if you read it carefully, that the U.S. wants to develop short-range nuclear weapons and make it more possible to use them under a variety of circumstances. I mean, that should worry everyone about Europe's security and global security in general. Go ahead, Ted.
Well, I want to pick up on a couple of things, Peter. What John said about NAFTA was very important. I'd characterize it slightly differently, but it's something we have to keep in the back of our minds. What Alice said about the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the pledge by all nuclear powers to do away with nuclear weapons is also extremely important. And there's a specific reason that we don't trust in stable nuclear deterrence anymore. We can't afford to. First off, NAFTA has been renegotiated. It was abrogated unilaterally. People said this is ridiculous. NAFTA took decades to negotiate. It'll take decades more to replace it. It didn't. It took a few months. Because basically, what you're dealing with in Donald Trump is someone that ghost wrote, or, you know, had ghost written for him, The Art of the Deal. Okay? This is how he operates. He's looking at changing paradigms whenever he can to get an advantage, either for himself personally or, in this case, for the United States. He's done that with NAFTA. I believe that's what he's up to with INF. I'm not worried about John Bolton. John Bolton was at the State Department for all those years that I was. He's a minor character at best. He says some pretty outrageous things, but if you've noticed, Donald Trump, his modus operandi includes surrounding himself with people that say outrageous things. What's important is what gets done in the end.
All right.
Now, to characterize Trump...
Hold on. Let me jump in here.
We don't care. Bolton.
I've got to go to a hard break here. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on Bolton's foreign policy. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Ted in Oxford. You said something very interesting right before we went to the break here. You characterized Bolton as kind of a bit character, but he seems, at least in public, in the way it's reported, he seems to have an enormous amount of sway over Donald Trump. Donald Trump came into office as being a hawk on Iran. Well, I don't think we need to explain to anyone watching this program about John Bolton's views of Iran. I worry very much about that. It's two people with the same mind and having the same goal and not showing any kind of restraint. Matter of fact, just the opposite. A lot of threats. Go ahead, Ted in Oxford.
Okay, I have to disagree, Peter. And
okay.
I base this not just on the 26 years I spent as a Foreign Service officer, but specifically on the years I spent at the U.S. mission to NATO as the arms control advisor to then Ambassador Ivo Dulder, who is himself a committed arms controller. And this was under President Obama. And you'll remember that Obama went to Prague in 2009, early on in his administration, and he talked about having a world free of nuclear weapons. And then at NATO, for the subsequent, you know, years of my tenure there, left in 2011, I saw the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy systematically dismantling any possibility of President Obama's Prague agenda being adopted, first by our European allies and then by anyone else. Okay? Obama was done in by his own cabinet, by the Department of Defense, and specifically by the Department of Energy. And when we talk military-industrial complex,
people
we're talking
like
about the people that design
people
and build nuclear weapons.
But people like John Bolton, correct?
No. Bolton has a hawkish attitude, okay? And he's useful sometimes for some things. But he's not DOD and he's not DOE, and those are the people you really have to worry about because they've got skin in the game. They're the ones that make money from nuclear war and every
fair.
Other kind.
That's okay. I absolutely agree with that here. Let me go to John here. But I still think the outlook and ideology, foreign policy ideology that John Bolton has, is having an impression on Donald Trump. I mean, the fact that Trump would announce this at a campaign rally, all of the European allies were caught flat-footed or didn't expect that he would make that announcement so clear. I mean, everything is done backwards. That's why I said it in my introduction here. I mean, wouldn't you discuss these things with your allies before you make a public statement? And, of course, the statement about the INF was made completely out of context for the audience to understand. So, I mean, that's why I started the program, Incoherent Foreign Policy. Though John Bolton seems to know what he wants. Go ahead, John.
Well, as far as talking to the allies, I mean, we have to remember that this puts millions of lives in Europe at danger. And you used to, when these weapons were there that the INF worked to ban, you had millions of people in the streets in Europe protesting against that gun that was put to their head. So, of course, you talk to the allies because it affects millions of people there. I do think Bolton's foreign policy is having a lot of influence right now, but Donald Trump does listen to his own counsel mostly, and we don't know where this is going to head. But you can see it in his Iran policy, which includes the horrific war in Yemen that we need to bring to an end, and you can see it in this approach to arms control. As far as renegotiating treaties and arms control agreements, I think Ted's right that they don't have to take a long time. I mean, you saw that at the dawn of the arms control era with the limited test ban treaty. But this is a little like repeal and replace when you're talking about replacing treaties, but you're just getting rid of something without really having a clear a demonstration of what it is you're going to replace it with. So I'd be very cautious about getting too excited about what Donald Trump's going to bring forward in terms of arms control. You know, that may come to pass because it would be a real feather in the cap of Donald Trump. Like with North Korea, he wants to be seen as a deal maker, but we should believe it when we see it.
You know, Alice, we have the New START treaty up for renewal in 2021. The American withdrawal from the INF treaty is, how do you see this? Because I agree with what Ted and John have said. I mean, it doesn't take a very long time. It does take time to update an agreement, and this in the START New START treaty is very important. But they should be working on it now, right? But if they're not working on it now, it looks like they're not going to pursue it. Again, another very important element of the arms control infrastructure is decaying in front of our eyes. Go ahead, Alice in New York.
I totally disagree.
Okay.
This is the treaty they should be looking at. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. 122 nations just voted for it. It's going through a ratification process. It needs 50. We have, I think, 15 nations. And this, like talking about arms control in the 21st century, it's so 20th century. It never worked. It wound up with Obama, you know, who said in his famous Prague speech, you know, I want to work for nuclear disarmament. It might not happen in my lifetime. And then Hillary misquoted him and said it might not happen in several lifetimes, quoting him wrong. I mean, we have to literally change the conversation, not talk about the little START treaty and the little IMF treaty.
Well, then, Alice, I have to disagree with you. I mean, we have to start somewhere. Let me go back to Ted in Oxford. Now, this is going to be an incremental process. With the massive military buildup going on in the United States, I don't expect Russia to get rid of its nuclear weapons anytime soon, particularly when American forces through NATO are on Russia's borders right now. That is its guarantee to sovereignty. Now, if we have agreements where we incrementally lower the number of warheads, that might be a logical start, I would say. Go ahead, Ted.
Well, I agree completely with Alice and disagree completely with you, Peter,
okay.
And here's why.
That's fine.
There are facts on the ground that we weren't aware of back in the 1980s when we were negotiating things like the INF Treaty. Back in the 1980s, scientists looked at computer modeling of atmospheric dynamics in the event of nuclear war, and they came up with a term, nuclear winter, which meant, we thought back then, that in the event of hundreds or possibly thousands of nuclear explosions up to and including the megaton range, that we would have to worry about the cold and the dark taking over, about ultraviolet radiation killing everything on the ground and in the ocean, so people starving, people burning, simultaneously people freezing, all of that we thought was a problem. And that was one of the things that led the leaders of the then Soviet Union and the United States of America to the negotiating table to get serious about reducing the obscene numbers of nuclear weapons that were lying around at that time. Now, fast forward to 2014, and modern computer science, and this is because of climate modeling, that we have computers and computer software this profound. We now know it only takes about 100 Hiroshima-sized weapons, and that's nothing. That's an aggregate total of 1.5 megatons of nuclear explosive force. If we pop that off, we end civilization as we know it, which means that there is no such thing as stable and reliable nuclear deterrence. It is an absurd concept in the face of what we now know about nuclear winter. And that's exactly why Alice is right. The INF ain't enough. New START ain't enough. We've got to look at a whole new way of getting down below 1.5 megatons of global nuclear capability. We have to do it. We are under the gun, literally, because right now, if Pakistan and India decided they don't like each other to the point where they will exchange nuclear weapons, civilization ends.
Okay, John, so if we continue the argument of Alice and Ted, so who cares about nonproliferation? Because that's what's going to happen here. Okay, then you're going to get a Saudi Arabia that's going to have nuclear weapons. Then you're going to get a Japan that wants to do it. And then maybe Taiwan will get into the act. I fundamentally disagree with Ted and Alice here. I think you have to start somewhere to get to that point where I think all of us would agree. But just saying, I don't see what political force is going to make that complete withdrawal of nuclear weapons on this earth. I don't see what political imperative will make that happen at this point in time. Go ahead, John, in San Francisco.
Well, I don't think the two perspectives are mutually exclusive. I think we need the urgency to realize it's too late. These weapons can destroy humanity. We need to ban them as soon as possible.
How?
I think that insight needs to be put out there.
How do we do that? John, how do you, I agree with all of you. How do we get there? John,
can
go
I
ahead.
Answer
no, no,
that?
No. Let John finish in
San
Francisco.
What I was going to say is that's not mutually exclusive from also having strong arms control agreements that move us in the right direction. But here in the United States, we should be putting pressure on our elected officials to embrace the treaty to ban nuclear weapons, while at the same time, we try to cut funding for new nuclear weapons in Congress, and we engage in nuclear diplomacy, whether it's with North Korea or with Russia or with anybody else. It has to be a holistic vision in which we can take incremental steps. At the same time, we have a very clear vision that we are working to ban nuclear weapons as quickly as possible. I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. If we get rid of the arms control regime and we allow the United States to spend $1.5 trillion rebuilding the nuclear infrastructure, we're never going to be able to ban nuclear weapons. So we have to bring it all together.
Okay, Alice in New York, give me the last word. Go ahead.
We have a project through the ICANN network that sort of spearheaded the adoption of the treaty. Don't bank on the bomb that we're working on the United States. Here in New York City, we're getting our city council to go to the controller, not to invest in nuclear weapons. I mean, there are a lot of things we can do in the nuclear weapons state, but you are ignoring this avalanche coming down on us with the climate catastrophe. I mean, within the next couple of years, if we don't do anything, the floods and the storms and the droughts and the refugee movement, that's going to draw our attention away from nuclear weapons and war. We have to have a war to make sure we get 100% solar and wind and hydro and efficiency. And that's something all our countries could be doing to the benefit of everybody. And that's another conversation. Instead of war, we need a war on climate catastrophe. That's where the war should be. That's where the money and the energy, we have to mobilize.
Okay, I have to jump in here. I wish it would be a war on the military-industrial complex, and then all four of us would be in agreement. That's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in New York, San Francisco, and in Oxford. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.